The doctor-patient relationship, along with thoughtful diagnosis, used to be the cornerstone of medical care. Recently, however, with the decline of small-town general practitioners and the increased dependence on more complicated and specialized machinery, medical care has become more expensive and less personalized. Dr. Lena Wen, an emergency room doctor at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, has a solution: less unnecessary testing and more individualized medicine, where doctors and patients work together to find a diagnosis. She and Dr. Joshua Kosowski have written a book called When Doctors Don't Listen: How to Avoid Misdiagnosis and Unnecessary Tests, which lays out how patients and doctors can communicate better to everyone's benefit. It's published by the Thomas Dunn imprint at St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it's brought Dr. Wen to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
And we're inviting our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question about how to deal with the doctor and get the best care, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Twitter or Facebook. A lot of different options out there. You explained that cookbook medicine has become the norm in American medical practice. What's cookbook medicine?
Well, I want to ask the listeners, if you've ever had an experience where you went to the doctor and you wanted to explain what happened, but then the doctor asks you, do you have chest pain? Do you have shortness of breath? Do you have headache? Almost as if your story didn't matter, that it was just a checklist of things that they were crossing off. That's cookbook medicine.
Well, in some cases, illnesses don't always follow all of those symptoms, you know, and hasn't that sometimes led to misdiagnosis? You have six of the 10 that the doctor is looking for, but those other four the doctor decides just discount it as that kind of problem?
That's exactly it. So studies have shown that 80% of diagnoses can be made just based on your history, the story of why you went to see the doctor in the first place. So by going through a checklist of questions, the doctor's actually going to miss your diagnosis.
But checklists are also important for other reasons. We had a rather wonderful writer about medical issues come by and talk about how checklists for doctors and pilots are really important.
Absolutely.
You can miss things.
Absolutely. So Atul Gawande, Peter Pronovost, some of our colleagues have done really amazing work with checklists. And I have to say, if I'm going through a surgery, I want to make sure that surgeon takes the extra time to do a checklist to make sure that my body is scrubbed and that every sponge is removed from my body, too. I think that's very important.
Because sponges have been left in people's
they
bodies.
They have been, absolutely. But I would say the difference is checklist for treatment or checklist for diagnosis. For diagnosis, it could be dangerous because then it supplants your story.
You also mentioned pathways. What are pathways?
Pathways are when you go to the doctor and you say you have, let's say, chest pain, and the doctor hears chest pain and says, okay, well, everybody who has chest pain gets exactly this type of treatment. That's a pathway. It's not personalized care.
Well, you work in emergency medicine. Wouldn't these pathways help you speed up the process of seeing patients so that you can attend to more people and also get somebody who's obviously in serious trouble some real, you know, something happening for them?
You're right that there is a role for some kind of decision-making process to see when somebody is ill and when not, and when they're not. But at the same time, it actually saves a lot more time down the line if the patient gets the right test rather than just the test that everyone with a particular symptom may get.
So were we practicing medicine better 50 years ago, when we didn't have all of these this cookbook medicine approach?
So I don't want to romanticize the way that things used to be too much and say that, oh, well, it was better in the era before antibiotics and before x-rays. But I do think that during those times, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, there wasn't other information available. So you couldn't just jump to a test and get blood, but you really have to listen to the story and listen to what brought the patient in the first place.
What about the popularity of WebMD, where patients can look up their symptoms on their own? Do patients often come to a doctor's office already having diagnosed themselves?
So I speak to patient advocacy groups where patients are really empowered, and they do tend to think that the best way to be empowered is to look up their symptoms and slap down these sheets of papers and say, look, you are misdiagnosing me. Here are the things that I have. I actually don't think that that's the right way to approach care. I think getting information is good, but knowing how to tell your story and partnering with your doctor, ensuring an equal partnership with your doctor, that's the way to get the best medical care.
My guess is Dr. Lena Nguyen, who has co-authored with Joshua Kozowski, another doctor, When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. It is published by the Thomas Dunn imprint, St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You give examples of patients who became trapped in the pathways. Can you tell us about what happened to Jerry the mechanic?
Sure. So we start the book by talking about Jerry, this 40-year-old man who was moving boxes over the weekend, and he felt that everything was just sore, that when he woke up in the morning, his arms were sore, legs were sore, back was sore, but his chest also felt kind of sore too. But he had heard that anytime you have pain in your chest, you need to go see the doctor, so he goes to the ER. When they heard chest pain, the all bets were off, and they said, okay, it's time. We're going to do EKGs and blood and chest x-ray, and you have to stay overnight. Let's make sure it's not a heart attack and a blood clot. Nobody at the end of the day, though, told him what was going on. He was told, congratulations, you have chest pain. And he said, but I came to you with chest pain, so what is it that I have? If we've gotten so far away from telling patients what's going on.
But heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. Doesn't it make sense that the doctors would think of a heart attack first, given the demographic that someone like Jerry falls into?
I would also argue, though, that doctors should think about the most likely diagnoses, that it's not just about ruling out problems that aren't necessarily the case, which is important to think about, you're right, but also to carefully consider what is the most likely.
Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about this. Christine, hi, you're on the air. Christine from Scarsdale.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. Are you feeling better these days?
Oh, I'm wonderful, actually. Thank you. 2 years ago, it's really kind of caricature. I was shoveling snow, and at the end of the day, I kind of didn't feel well, so I went to a hospital. I went to the hospital. They took my blood pressure, did an EKG. Everything was normal. There was no variation in anything. They did blood work. And after sitting there for hours and there was no change in my blood pressure or anything else, they were going to release me against medical advice. And then at the last minute, someone went western and said, oh, no, your blood chemistry shows that you've had an event. So I was put in the hospital. The next thing I know, the next day, my doctor is a cardiologist. My internist is a cardiologist. The next day I know, I'm in the cath lab, and they're doing catheterization to put a stent in. And when they got in there, absolutely there was nothing. The guy said, okay, we're done. You've got nothing here. Now, my doctor is someone I've been going to for the last 15 years. My cholesterol levels have always been extraordinarily low. And it kind of annoyed me that all of a sudden, here I am in the hospital having this really expensive procedure, and there was absolutely no reason for it. How can you avoid this kind of situation?
And what did it wind up being? Do we know?
After I went to another cardiologist, it was kind of a micro event, is what they said. Women apparently have different kind of heart attacks, and there was absolutely nothing to be seen on any of the tests that they did, but because of it was so cold and I was working, I was actually chopping ice, that he said it was some sort of a micro-event that only showed up in the blood chemistry.
Dr. Nguyen, you were nodding your head and smiling while she was telling that story. This is not a unique story?
Not at all. Unfortunately, Christine, your story is one that I hear everywhere that I go, because people talk about being forced down these pathways, right, where somebody is thinking, well, you are in the right demographic, or you are at risk for having this bad problem, and therefore we need to, quote-unquote, work it up without really looking at the bigger picture. But I would say, too, that what strikes me in your story is the lack of communication, because people kept on coming up to you and say, well, you had this blood work done, and you need to leave against medical advice. But it sounds like people did not, the doctors and nurses did not actually communicate and involve you as a partner in deciding what to do next.
Well, what could Christine have done, or Jerry in your book, have done to make the situation different?
Well, I would say two major things. The first is to make sure that they convey the story. Again, if we know that so much of diagnoses can be made, such a large percentage of diagnoses can be made based on the story, making sure you tell the story and making sure if the doctor or the nurse, they seem to go in a different tangent or they glaze over, to keep on going back to why you came in the first place. And the second thing is to keep on asking, what is going on? What is my diagnosis? What are you thinking? What are these tests for? Because you have to know what's going on with your care.
But most people are nervous about confronting or questioning their doctor. They've come with the problem. The doctor is supposed to have the solution.
That's right. And I'll tell you a story about this as well. And the reason why I wrote the book with my mentor at the Brigham. My mother was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was a medical student. But it was only after more than a year of misdiagnoses where people kept on telling her that she didn't have things. Actually, they told her that even though she was coughing up blood and feeling weak, that they thought she was depressed and gave her Prozac.
They often blame the patient when they don't know what it is.
That's right.
At least that's the complaint I've heard from a lot of people.
Exactly. And so to your point, it is the doctor's duty to do better, and it is the duty of our health system to do better. But in the meantime, patients have to do something.
But people are often worried that they'll be seen as a difficult patient and taken less seriously if they complain. Do you find that patients who speak up are more likely to be labeled that way by doctors?
It's a question of how you speak up. So my mother, too, was so afraid that if she said something or questioned the doctor, that she would be labeled as the bad patient and that she would somehow get bad care. But there is a way of asking for help. You should not say, for example, well, I don't trust you. You're misdiagnosing me. That's probably not the right approach. But if you say, I would like to be involved as a partner in my health because I know myself the best and I have some questions to ask you, a reasonable doctor would involve you and be happy, would actually welcome your giving them the permission to practice good medicine.
What happens when a patient is out of it and can't communicate effectively or reliably with the doctor or the medical team?
Great question. So two things. The first is that I encourage all of my patients and everyone in general to bring someone with them, an advocate of some type, a family member, a trusted friend, someone to go with them. But to your point, too, about just when you're not feeling well, even if you're not comatose, even if you have the flu, you just feel poorly. And then what I would recommend is the time to begin to be an empowered patient is not in that moment. It's to practice it well in advance when you go for your regular checkup, when you have a sore throat, because that's when you can really learn how to be a partner.
Another listener left a comment saying, I was hospitalized last year, and while I liked my doctors, many of them seemed to be on 24-hour shifts. They were fine when they were on hour one, but dealing with them around hour 23 was a little less reassuring. Why do we put such crazy time demands on medical professionals?
Great point. And I would say it's not just the time in terms of how much medical professionals work, but also how little time they have to spend with their patients. It is a problem. But again, I think that we as patients can stand up and say something about this. We should not be too sympathetic to the doctors.
On the other hand, I've heard about cases where there were problems because the nurse who prepared the patient for surgery wasn't present at the procedure because the patient had been moved to a different operating room. The nursing team changed in the middle of the procedure. So things can go wrong.
This is an issue that we're really struggling with this in the medical profession. Work hour regulations are now getting enforced in residency training, which I think is excellent to protect patients and residents too. But there is the handoff issue, right? You don't want to come to the hospital and see 10 different people and not know who's in charge of your care. So that is something that the health system needs to get sorted out as well.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. I also wanted to talk to Dr. Nguyen about why diagnosing patients' illnesses is so difficult. What actually goes on when you show up with a problem? Her book, written with her mentor, another doctor, Joshua Kozowski, is published by the Thomas Dunn imprint of St. Martin's Press. It's called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. The number again, 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org, or you can tweet us, or you can leave a message on our Facebook page. Any way you find easiest for you, We invite you to do it. And we're back with Dr. Lena Wen, who, with Dr. Joshua Kosofsky, has written When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. It is published by St. Martin's Press. We invite your calls, 212-433-9692. And before we get to just what you do when you are trying to diagnose somebody with a problem, I thought I would put, is it Jean? Hi, Jean from Jersey City.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Thank you. For the chance to do this, I've always wanted to call a radio show. I'm a medical technologist, and I've worked 30 years in hospital. And one experience I remember was I was doing some lab work on a patient, and the doctor told us, he came down and wanted to know what the results were, and I told him it was negative. He was upset because he said, I'm sure my patient has lupus. And I told him, well, I don't find anything to confirm your diagnosis. So he got very upset. You know, like I said, he was upset. And he wanted me to look at it again. And I said, I'll look at it again. I did. And then I told him that it's still negative. And he says, well, I have to treat my patient. So I just told him, I said, well, you need to go on and treat your patient because you're not supposed to be treating lab tests. And he even got more upset. So he took it to the pathologist. And I happened to be where I could see the pathologist talking to him. The pathologist told him the same thing. If your patient has it, then you have to treat them. But they don't listen sometimes, even when you give them, have affirmative or negative tests in front of them. And we also had a young patient who was born, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with the infant, and they kept trying to figure out and doing diagnostic work. And when we looked at the patient's name, it was a small town. All the patients, you knew all of your patients. And I just told him, I said, check your history on the patient. The patient's father has sickle cell, and the mother is a carrier. So the baby has sickle cell. And that was the last we heard of it. But they have to listen. Even when you're in the face of whatever you have to present to them, they need to listen to you.
And we've been talking about patients communicating with doctors. What Jean has talked about is something that I've also heard a lot about. Nurses often know more about what's going on than the doctors because they are there with the patient for a longer time. Doctors have to listen to the rest of the staff, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. It's very much of a team effort. And nurses, as you said, really are wonderful listeners, and they do spend a lot more time with patients. But I also think Jean made some other great points, too, about treating the patient and not the test, that it's so important to hear the history and to go based on the history. There's an old saying that if you want to find out what's going on, just ask the patient, because the patient will tell you exactly what's going on with her or him.
Thank you so much for calling us, Jean.
Okay, thank you.
And now we go to Julie in Manhattan. Hi, Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to address something that you hear a lot, which is physicians complaining about tort reform because of the malpractice issue. And when your doctor says it's important to treat what is most likely and kind of berates the physician for working up somebody who had some sort of chest pain after shoveling ice, we are left in the position of not being allowed to miss any things that could kill people when they come in. That includes heart attacks or other things. So I can relate to you my personal experience of my 1 in 1,000 child with a fever that came in, went home and died of a very rare illness, just a few cases in the literature. And even though I had documented that I had partnered with the mother to discuss whether the child should have laboratories, I did not feel that the child did. The child, my care, as documented, was the exact standard of care that should have been provided. But my hospital went ahead, settled the case after I spent 4 years of my life being embroiled in this lawsuit. And it's changed my practice because I'm not going to be the one to take the fall and spend 4 years of my life wrapped up in a lawsuit that I then have to report just to treat what is most likely, because I'm going to be held to the standard of care of what could ever happen to this person once they leave my department.
What Julie's talking about is part of a right now become a very controversial aspect of medicine called second victim, where the doctors feel that they are victims as well, even if they do all the things that they think are right and it doesn't work out and it ends in failure. They feel guilt, and it affects the way they approach patients in the future.
That's right.
Some patient groups really are annoyed by this kind of thinking. They feel that the doctors are kind of rationalizing a situation where they ultimately should be held responsible.
I think everyone recognizes, though, that tort reform is necessary, not just because of defensive medicine and the issues that Julie was mentioning, but also because it's really not good for anyone. We want to address medical error, right? And we do want people to get better. We want patients to get better care and doctors to be better. But maybe the right way to do this is not the way that it is now. But, you know, Julie, I really feel terrible about your experience. I think that so many people can relate. I mean, everyone, every doctor knows of someone who was sued or was part of an adverse action at this point. And I guess the only thing that I can offer in this case is that I don't know about your specific situation, but we do know that the majority of lawsuits happen because of miscommunication. And it doesn't sound like that was the case with you at all, but that is something that we want for patients and doctors to take away, that they really need a partner, as you are saying, to get better care.
It sounds to me, Julie, like it didn't work out all that well.
No, it didn't. And in fact, I was told that the patient denied that I had ever had this conversation, or the patient's mother denied that I ever had this conversation with her, even though I had documented it in the medical record.
Well, good luck. A number of listeners are curious about how to go about getting a second opinion and the necessity of one. If you're in an emergency room, it's hard to get a second opinion.
It's hard to get a second opinion, but it is possible. I would say, though, before you ask for a second opinion, make sure that you're actually asking for the first opinion correctly. A lot of people will just give up if they ask once, but ask again. Enlist the nurse as an advocate in that process as well.
Well, you call diagnosis an art. Should we expect all of our doctors to be artists?
We should expect all of our doctors to practice both the art and the science of medicine. There is so much in medicine that's not just about formulas and pathways, and because there's so much about medicine that we don't know. And the human aspect of medicine, the empathy, that's also why people go to their doctors as well, to feel better at the end of the day.
And are you suggesting that the art of diagnosis is being lost?
The art of diagnosis is something that I believe every physician is capable of. But they put it by the wayside in favor of cookbook because of all the pressures that people mentioned, the fear of malpractice, the pressures on time, all these things that we've been talking about are actual problems. But we can bring back the art of diagnosis with the patient's help.
So can you explain how doctors come up with a working diagnosis?
Sure. So a lot of my book, When Doctors Don't Listen, is about how doctors think and how they get to the diagnosis. And doctors start hearing the story, and almost immediately they zero in on what's called the chief complaint, what they think is your main reason for coming in. That chief complaint may not be correct, so you have to make sure that is actually correct. But then they formulate in their head a differential diagnosis, which is a list of all the possible things that you could possibly have. Then they narrow it down to the working diagnosis. Sometimes you need tests to do that. Sometimes they just know. But my point, though, is you should always know about what your doctor's thinking. Why not ask your doctor about what the differential diagnosis is, what the working diagnosis is, so that you also understand why things are happening as they are?
Well, why were the doctors that you spoke to often hesitant to share the working diagnoses with their patients?
Part of it is time. Part of it is they are afraid to show uncertainty. So much in medical school, we learn about how we have to get the right answer, and saying that I don't know is not an option. That's why it's so important for patients to give their doctors permission to not know 100%. Even if you're not 100% sure, still tell me about what's going on.
So the doctor should share their thought processes with their patients.
If that's what the patient wants, and I think most patients would like that.
Well, doctors are also afraid of saying, well, I'm worried that this might be a brain tumor, or you might be having some really serious problem and you're going to die in 3 days. Doctors often hide that from a patient, don't they?
They hide that, but they also hide things like, I don't think you have anything really going on. I think you just have a muscle strain. They hide that much more than actually some serious problem.
It's the reason that doctors often used to give antibiotics for people who came in with flu, even though viruses don't respond to antibiotics.
That's exactly it.
A way of quieting the patient.
Right. And as a way of appeasing the patient. So many patients do come in and say, I have back pain. I need an MRI. It's much easier to say, okay, go get your MRI, instead of counseling on rest and on what actually will help the patient feel better at the end.
You've come up with an 8 pillars list for patients. What are those 8 pillars?
The 8 pillars to better diagnosis helps the patient get to your right diagnosis, which I really believe is the key to everything else that follows. If you don't know what you have, how could you begin treatment? How could you know what to expect? And so it's to help you in every encounter with your doctor to go through these 8 steps.
Well, one of the steps might be, why do I need this test? You talk about the prevalence of unnecessary tests. Julie mentioned it as well. How can we tell whether a test is necessary or not?
You can't know whether it's unnecessary, but you have to ask the question, which is, why am I getting this test? Every patient knows that treatments have side effects, right? You know that if you go through chemotherapy or surgery, you always ask about the risks. But patients do not ask about the risks of testing, but every test has risks. So always ask, why is this test being done? If your doctor has no answer for that, that is an unnecessary test.
What kind of risks does an MRI have other than it's going to cost you a lot of money?
So a couple of things. The first is that most MRIs use a dye that could result in allergic reaction or even kidney failure. And second is that MRIs will often turn up some other information. And there is a danger to getting this extra information because there could be what we call incidental findings of things that never needed further investigation. And also, if the MRI is negative, then what do you do? What is the diagnosis? What is the plan? That's why it's so important to find out why this test is being done.
But isn't it a good thing that modern medicine now has advanced tests that can do things like screen for cancer and detect blood clots? How can we... If we don't take those tests, then we might not find out.
So I work at a major research institution and in Harvard Medical School, and I hardly would say that we should abandon tests altogether. I think my colleagues would definitely say, what are you doing? No, I think it's the combination of art and science that's so important. We have to recognize that there are these tests available, but use them thoughtfully.
And sometimes tests turn out to be wrong, don't they?
Tests turn out to be wrong.
And false positives?
That's right, and false negatives too. So if a test is negative, you may be falsely reassured that, quote, nothing is wrong with you, but something is going on.
Now, you did your residency under Dr. Kozowski, your co-author here. He's an older-time physician. Does he practice medicine differently than the doctors of your generation?
There are certain physicians who we call the expert clinicians, the people who we learn from clinical skills and really this art of medicine, but too few of them. I actually do think that the newer generation is getting better because there's so much more in our curriculum about empathy and listening. So that is something that we are working to change.
So medical schools are adjusting? Because in the past, they were blamed for many of the problems.
I believe so. There was a time when science was what was solely emphasized in medical school, but that is changing, but not quickly enough.
We don't have much time, but I want to sneak Dr. Harf from Carmel, New Jersey, in here. Can you make it very quick, doctor?
Visiting doctor out in a medical center out in California during Operation Desert Storm, and I was a reservist. And since I was a family doctor, they asked me to attend the family practice residency morning rounds. And one Monday morning, they presented a case of a man who was found in between two cars on a parking lot and used car parking lot, and they worked him up. They presented the case as working him up for heart attack, stroke, seizure, whatever. And in the presentation, they also mentioned that he had abrasions on both his palms. And I said, that's a pure sign that this man tripped and fell and hit his head rather than had a heart attack or anything else. And, of course, all their tests were negative, and simple physical examination and some clinical intuition would have saved the man a lot of problems and everybody else a lot of expense.
A perfect example of what you've been talking about. Thank you so much for your call, and thank you so much, Dr. Lena Wen, who with Joshua Kozowski has written When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. The book is published by Thomas Dunn Books imprint at St. Martin's Press. And in talking to patients about this book, do you think that we're going to get smarter?
I think that patients are very much on board with this movement. I actually consider this to be a minor revolution in healthcare, and we really need our patients and doctors to work together to empower ourselves to better health.
Thanks again.